So some people are changed by the national parks. Others change the parks themselves. Back in the 1950s, it was illegal to climb in Yosemite National Park. But then a group of daredevil climbers took on the National Park Service. There's a new documentary, Valley Uprising, that tells the story of the climbers who first dared El Capitan, Yosemite's infamous 3,000-foot granite wall. Nick Rosen is the film's director. Steve Paulson caught up with him.
Tell me about a couple of the people from back then. And there was this bitter rivalry between these two guys, Royal Robbins and Warren Harding, and totally different kinds of people with totally different philosophies on what it meant to climb in Yosemite.
Yeah, so on the one hand, you had Royal Robbins, who is probably the greatest rock climber of his day and certainly a leader among the Yosemite climbers and the Yosemite climbing movement. And this, he really saw climbing as this heroic endeavor, something that you should be taken very, very seriously. And he felt that also climbing had to have a certain set of rules associated with it. And it's easy to understand his position back then. Again, this was the infancy of rock climbing. There was really no standard set for how these giant walls in Yosemite should be climbed. And so he
didn't want you to sort of hammer in bolts and pitons and just sort of have them there forever so you just kind of haul yourself up the cliff.
Essentially, you know, Robbins was against bolts, permanent pieces of metal that were drilled into the rock for protection. You know, he just saw this as a bridge too far. So,
let's contrast him then with his great rival, Warren Harding, who was the total opposite. This hard-drinking guy who would haul brandy and wine up on his climbs.
Yeah. Warren Harding was pretty much the opposite of Royal Robbins. You know, where Royal saw climbing as this very spiritual, elevated endeavor, Warren Harding just saw it as an excuse to have fun. You know, Warren Harding saw climbing as something that should have no rules, that is the perfect manifestation of freedom up there. And they had a sort of this epic rivalry because as much as they were different, the two men were also really united by their desire to be the first to climb El Capitan.
So who got up El Capitan first?
Well, it turned out that it was Warren Harding who got up El Capitan first. Royal Robbins was very displeased with the methods that Harding used to make the first ascent of this route called the Nose, which is the beautiful central prow of El Capitan. Warren Harding was like going up for a little while, fixing ropes to the wall so that he can come back down, party for a while in Camp 4, get really drunk, head hungover, get drunk again, go up the wall again. He was bringing up, as we say, lots of food and wine and brandy. They called it a high-altitude gastronomic orgy.
It was a reaction against the whole high-minded ideals of climbing.
He often described Royal Robbins as way too serious. And he always considered Robbins and his people to be the Valley Christians. The Valley Christians expected everyone to climb exactly as they climb.
Does that annoy me? Did it? Yes. Yes. That was a derisive comment.
The other piece of this story, really about the history of rock climbing in Yosemite, is there was kind of an ongoing battle between the climbers and the park rangers. Because the climbers, I mean, a lot of these were outlaws. I mean, they were rebels. Yeah. I mean, they were out camping in the backcountry, eluding the rangers who, you know, they were breaking all the rules. What was the nature of that struggle between these two groups?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look back at the 1950s and 60s, you can sort of track it to the kind of culture clash that was going on in the United States at the time. You had a very conservative, staid, kind of law and order oriented group of people in the National Park Service, particularly the National Park Rangers. And then all of a sudden, these crazy long-haired climber types start moving into Camp 4 and using it as a base for unbridled freedom.
And there were a lot of drugs. Yeah. There was a lot of drinking, probably a fair amount of sex.
Yeah, it was pretty rowdy back then. But even then in the 1950s and 60s was tame compared to the generations that would come. The 1970s, when the Stonemasters arrived, was really the the sex, drugs, rock and roll era of Yosemite climbing. And so they were even wilder. Things were getting completely out of control. They owned Camp 4 in this way that they would just do whatever they want and having wild parties, taking acid and climbing El Capitan.
Well, I mean, they were climbing El Capitan on LSD.
That's correct. Yes. So
that sounds totally crazy.
Jim Bridwell was some kind of new force, if you will.
New roots on El Cap, bold, dangerous stuff.
For me, it's mainly a thing about, you know, how far you can push it. Exploring not only my environment, but myself at the same time.
One makes you larger and...
There's a definite fearlessness that comes with that liberation of the personality.
Most of what we've been talking about was a very macho culture of climbers. I mean, the testosterone was just, you know, it was high there. But there were exceptions. I mean, there were some amazing women climbers. And probably the most famous was Lynn Hill. Tell me about Lynn.
Yeah, so Lynn was, you know, a very young 16, 17-year-old girl who showed up at the scene in Camp 4, sort of at the height of the Stonemasters revolution. And these were, as you say, very macho, testosterone-driven, muscly dudes. Lynn Hill was an extraordinary athlete. I mean, she could have been a famous gymnast. She was an Olympic-level athlete. And, you know, I think she had the world record bench press for women of her size. She was just an incredible physical specimen. When she fell in with the Stonemasters, she quickly excelled and was doing things that the guys couldn't accomplish themselves. And, you know, there was nothing but the kind of social structures that was holding Lynn back. And she really busted through that glass ceiling and accomplished things that would be legendary in the climbing world for men or for women.
Well, didn't she do the first free ascent of the nose of El Capitan?
That's right. And using just the strength of her own body and a rope just to catch her if she fell, this free climbing technique that was revolutionary in the 1970s and she really developed, was able to climb the route in a day.
It's the most historic, famous big wall climb in the world. And it seemed like the best culmination of all of my skills as a climber.
Until now, every party that went up the nose, from Warren Harding to Jim Bridwell, Pat Aide climbed the route, hanging on their gear to reach the top.
And the next big step was, when was it going to be free climbing?
A free ascent of the nose would mark the ultimate fulfillment of the free climbing revolution launched by the Stonemasters in the 70s.
Free climbing the nose was a prize. All the most visionary climbers kept trying it and going after it. They wanted it. And here's Lynn, and she crushes it. Oh my God, El Cap can be free climbed. It was groundbreaking, earth-shattering, and it was a woman.
It goes, boys.
Well, then more recently, in the last couple of decades, there has been yet another generation of climbers at Yosemite doing truly astonishing things without any ropes at all. I mean, this is just incredibly dangerous. I mean, some of these guys and women as well go up thousands of feet of cliff without being tethered. I mean, if they fall, they die.
Starting in the 1970s, the high-stakes discipline of free solo climbing, that is, climbing without ropes, where, you know, one slip of the foot can mean you fall to your death, it always has been really just the province of the most elite, most bold, most confident climbers. But it is a tradition in Yosemite, and over the years, you've seen climbers apply this style of climbing to more and more difficult and bigger routes, to the point where now you're seeing someone like Alex Honnold climb the whole face of Half Dome, 2,000 feet, very difficult climbing without using a rope. It just would have been inconceivable to previous generations.
The tension within any national park, but especially at Yosemite, between these incredibly accomplished climbers, I mean, world-class climbers who are doing things that only a handful of people can do and, you know, breaking the rules to do it. And then, you know, on the other hand, you have to think about the, 4 million people who come to Yosemite every year, mostly in cars, you know, who want access to the park as well. I mean, you can see what the National Park Service is up against, trying to accommodate all these needs.
Yeah, you really can. I mean, I have somewhat sympathy for some of the national park policies trying to manage. So what they've done is put camping limits on the amount of time that you can camp in Yosemite. And in the modern era, that's put climbers in a very tough position, because these climbers, the only way that they accomplish these amazing things on these walls is to live there at the foot of the wall in Camp 4 or in the trees in the forest and devote themselves day to day to day, again and again and again, going up there and practicing their climbing arts. And so they basically have to live there full time, but it's prohibited to stay longer than 2 weeks. And so very often, climbers are living outside of the law, hiding in caves and living in the forest and getting chased down by rangers for out-of-bounds camping. But climbers, you know, they're going to pursue their dreams and their goals despite the rules. I think if anything has taught us over the generations, this culture of people isn't going to let a few camping rules get in their way.
Nick Rosen is the director of the documentary Valley Uprising, Yosemite's Rock Climbing Revolution. Steve Paulson talked with him.